any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get callous and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Streaming into the Hollywood Abyss is brought to you by Scriptation, the Emmy
Award. It sounds awful when you say it. Let somebody with a more charming accent do this bit. Screaming into the Hollywood Abyss is brought to you by Scriptation, the Emmy Award-winning app for anyone that reads scripts, makes notes, organise them into layers and save hours of time by automatically transferring those notes into new script revisions. Cither listeners can get a free month of Scriptation by going to scriptation.com/Cither. Now that's how you do it, Noah. Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure and adversity in the entertainment industry. I am, as ever, your English co-host and the second most successful podcaster on this show, as you're about to find out why.
And I'm your industry co-host, Noah Ebslin. On today's Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, we're excited to have on longtime friend of the pod, as well as screenwriter, memoirist and podcaster Paul Bay. Paul created two enormously successful fiction podcasts called The Big Loop and Black Tapes. He's also sold multiple TV projects to Amazon, AMC, NBC, Universal, as well as directed an audio drama for Marvel. Top of writing, Paul is also an actor and a comedian. Paul's breakout role as delivery man in Fringe propelled him to such roles as store owner in Supernatural and Officer Yu in their interview. Welcome, Paul. I know Dan normally asks the first question, but before we officially start, do you still remember your line as the delivery man on Fringe?
Yeah, because they cut it. I went from a guy with a line to a guy who just had to look surprised as a delivery man. And then because I snapped my Achilles tendon during that scene, they had to pull me off the road and just use my delivery bicycle as a stand-in while the truck barreled down on it.
Thank you.
So Paul is as Noah said, he's a friend of the podcast. He's been very supportive for all the things we wanted to do. He's also been desperate to get on here and keeps asking us, and we keep telling him that he hasn't failed quite enough yet. But I think he's probably failed enough now that he qualifies to be on the podcast. I want to talk to you about your sort of journey, because you ended up with, unless it's changed, one of the most successful and most listened to scripted podcasts. But that actually came effectively as a result of a failure, because you couldn't do it as a TV show. So can you tell us how you became a very, very successful podcaster because you weren't able to be successful somewhere else?
We became, as you say, very, very successful in podcasting because we're very, very, very failure laden in screenwriting. My good friend Terry Miles, I was a very, very poor actor in his first film he ever made. I think it's called Yumi in Love or something, and I was one of the leads, strangely enough. And you know, of course, it didn't go out because I sucked so much. And so, but instead of being Terry's actor in his great movies afterwards, we became friends, you know, keep me in the loop. Where I failed as an actor, I became an excellent friend. And one day we're just sitting there going, let's make a movie together. And he said, do you have any ideas? And I said, I have a movie called The Black Tape I want to write about a ghost hunter who doesn't believe in ghosts. So we wrote that in 5 days and gave it to his agent, who I won't name, and Terry since parted with. But we gave it to him and waited. We waited a year. He said it might be going to somewhere. We waited 2 years. You know how it goes. And then all of a sudden we realized it's not going anywhere. So we turned it into a podcast because Serial was huge at the time. And we thought, I just had a frustration. I said, too bad we can't turn our screenplay into a podcast. And Terry, being a former musician who mixed his own music and a DIY director of indie films, a pretty successful one at that, he said, why the hell not? And that's how it started.
Which is extraordinary. And tell us how, for those of people who don't follow these things, how successful are we talking? We're talking how many millions of downloads?
We're not the most. So BBC did this. The BBC did a study on English audio drama in North America, and apparently we were the third most downloaded after some long-running shows. But in terms of per episode downloads, I think we might have been number one. I think we had something like 1.3 million at the time per episode. 1.3 million downloads per episode, which is for fiction. You know, it's not. It only came out once every 2 weeks. Or a 12-episode run for 2.5 seasons. So it's not like a talk show where people come in all the time. So the numbers are pretty good on an episode-per-episode basis for fiction.
Yeah, look, you know, 1.3 million is extraordinary, and we're very jealous of those numbers. Although, actually, if I'd known you were only number three, we might not have invited you on the podcast. We thought you were more successful. We tried to only go for the top two. So just last question from me. It's just slightly. This is a very specific failure story, but obviously, you were on one of my other podcasts first. You came on my whiskey podcast, and you told a brilliant story about the interview and what you did in the audition for that, and then what happened as a result, and then obviously having your head blown off in part of the show. Can you just tell, because it's a great story of a very specific type of failure for an actor. Can you just tell us about what you did in that audition with your Korean and then what happened?
Yeah, and the worst part of that is they brought me out of retirement for that. So I was happily retired, back to teaching and whatever. And then my former acting agent says, listen, can you come back in one more time? I felt like this romantic cowboy asked to put on his spurs and his gun belt and his holster. He said, you know, Seth Rogen and his company really want a Korean to play these North Korean soldiers. And my parents are from North Korea, so I thought, you know, this is a good way to pay tribute to my parents' heritage by playing a North Korean soldier. I don't know what I was thinking. So I went in, and my Korean's not that good. I got my dad to translate the lines, the English lines that they gave me, into Korean. I went in, and it started fabulously. I think I was about 30 seconds in. I could see the casting director and everyone getting really impressed by the words coming out of my mouth. And then I think because I'm a comedian, when I saw their reactions, it threw me off. I'm used to playing in dark rooms or riffing off of an expression. One of them had an expression. I wanted to joke off of it. And then I lost my place. And I forgot my Korean. I lost my rhythm. So I started naming off all these. I started saying like, jajangmyeon, kimchi, galbi, waegeurae, galbitang. And just naming off Korean menu items that I knew. And no one had any idea I was doing that. And so my agent called me all excited right after the audition. He was like, hey, I heard you rocked it. I'm like, awesome. Because you probably got the part. They just got to check it with a Korean translator to make sure you said the lines. So I went from the guy with the most lines out of the two to the guy with almost nothing to say. But at least I was on screen to get my head blown off at a very pivotal point, which is the height of my acting success.
Paul, I think you have the rare honor of being someone who's come on our podcast more than once. Obviously, you've come on as kind of a guest co-host, and we mine some of these stories a little bit because we obviously wanted to chat about your stories as well. And we have been, unlike Dan said, trying to get Paul on for a long time as a guest himself, not as a co-host, which I'm sure we'll bring you back one day as a co-host, but as a guest to kind of probe into your story. Because one of the things that I really like about you on social media is how sort of honest you are about how hard things can be. And we know, and we talk about a little bit here about this breakout success, obviously of your audio career, your podcast career, which sort of segued you into a film and TV career, something you've been, you know, trying to do for a while. But my question right now, obviously we're a podcast, as you well know, about failure, rejection, and adversity. So my question really is about, were you surprised after you got some heat? And you definitely have some heat, and you had some heat back then. How hard it is still to get any traction in this business?
Yeah, it's you know, because I was new. In 2018, I sold my first... I guess I can talk about it now. Everyone thinks the Black Tapes was my first TV sale, but it was actually the Big Loop. I had sold the Big Loop to a network just a few months before the Black Tapes, and I sort of sold it while I was down in LA getting ready to pitch the Black Tapes. So I went into that pitch without knowing it was a pitch. I thought it was just a meeting with some executives that happened to be a fan of the Big Loop. And so when that happened, and then all of a sudden the Black Tapes happened, and then I got an agent, and they're like, "You're on fire. You're going to have a career in Hollywood." My wife and I were thinking of selling everything here and moving down there, because the next week, I've been selling a pilot a year. And I thought, this is it. And then my agent says, "I think it's time for an overall deal." Now, I had no clue what an overall deal was at the time. He says, "I'm going to try to get you one." And I love the guy. And he came back, went to a major studio, came back with the offer. I remember he's saying, "It's nothing. Let's ignore this and just keep doing what we're doing." And I said, "Well, at least tell me the number." And he told me the number. And I remember thinking, "Well, hey, cheer up. It's not so bad. I can go back to teaching and double that right now." And that's how low that number was. And I had no business even thinking of an overall deal. But, you know, people around you in Hollywood sort of pump you up when you have a certain type of momentum. And I get it. Like, it's like when you play sports, your coach will tell you, "You're on fire. You take the ball, just go." In Hollywood, I found that I have to just sort of winnow out these voices and sort of like find a way to sort of really listen to what the truth behind all the voices are. Some people are saying great things just to pump you up because they think you need it, or to just keep you going, or you know, just any type of motivation or any type of wind under your sails in this business is helps. But at other times, for people like me who have no idea what the landscape was at the time and what these words meant and what these deals meant, I learned to pay closer attention to what they mean and what not to listen to, but yet appreciate the motivation behind saying those things at the same time. So it's a lot of illusion. You always hear about Hollywood and its illusions, and then when you get through when you try to jump into that pool, you find out it's just desert sand. There's a lot of that in this industry.
Illusions mixed with a lot of delusions. Now, I do want to add, you know, to your thing that selling a pilot a year is pretty damn good, especially in this environment. Recently, it's been really hard for anyone to make any sales at all. But was there any time since you've switched from being a teacher, which you famously chronicled in your memoir, since you switched from being a comedian, since you switched from being an actor? You've had a number of careers that have brought you to this moment where you're like, "Damn it, I think I made a mistake. Maybe I'm going to go back and just, you know, it's just, there's just too much constant rejection, too much constant failures. And maybe it's time to just, you know, take a pause or do something else."
I think, you know, the only time I ever felt that, like a tinge of regret that maybe I made the bad, worst decision, is I had this, I got a development deal with this Canadian TV company, and they gave me a daily TV show with some of my comedian friends. It was called The City News List, and it was basically a really budget version of The Daily Show for local politics. And we would joke about these local political issues, and it's four comedians, and I was the host of it, the anchor. And we had that every day, Monday to Friday. We'd do the writer's room in the morning, come out and sit around the table and make these jokes. And, you know, we had a small fan base. And I remember thinking, I don't know if this is going to last. Because even if you start paying attention, I remember that we had a big meeting for new lights for the set. I'm like, "Oh, I'm excited now." And the lights never came. I'm like, "Oh, crap, we're about to get canceled." So I remember, so I was expecting it. I didn't decorate my office at all or my cubicle area. But on the day that we got fired, I felt the sense of relief that I was partly right. You know, that the relief you get was, "I knew it. I'm relieved now." But then following that is, "Oh shit, what am I going to do for money now?" And I had, thank God, I had friends from teaching, and I, you know, asked them, "Can I come back?" And I had to sub all over again and start from the bottom. And I remember during that year, and also my wife and she opened up a new business, and she thought, "Do you think this, we could do this easily as long as you keep that daily talk show job?" I'm like, "I don't know." And as soon as we opened up that new business, the show got canceled. And so it was really financially challenging that year. And I started taking tutoring jobs again. And I went from a touring comedian with a daily talk show to now substitute teaching and taking these night jobs at these academies. And I remember thinking at the time, this sucks. This is I'm not used to this. I haven't experienced this type of instability. If I want to be this financially unstable, I would have stayed a comedian. But at least it's something I enjoy. But this is teaching at different schools with no connection to the students. It really hurt. And that might have been the darkest place I'd hit. But even then, it wasn't that bad because my wife and I had each other. And we knew if we worked hard and if I had a little bit of luck, I'll end up a full-time teacher again and our business is going to grow. It was bound to grow. And it did. The business grew. I got my full-time teaching back and then it went great. But it was a year of a lot of did I do the right thing going through my head.
So for those people who follow you on social media, you know, you live in an extraordinary part of the world with amazing views. You've got your dogs around you. You've got an incredible selection of whiskey. You've got this sort of solitude and peacefulness that most people can't have because there aren't properties like yours in the middle of LA. And if there were, there'd be, you know, $30 million. Does it help you? You know, we've talked to people before about, you know, whether they should have moved down here. Does it help their career? So I guess the flip side of that is being in such a relaxing place and being away from all of the nonsense of Hollywood and the delusions and illusions, does that actually allow you to be a better writer because of that background? Or actually, do you think if you gave all up and came and rented a very cheap flat somewhere in the middle of Hollywood that you'd be able to crack into the industry more quickly?
I'll be honest, if I was in LA, I think I'd be socializing way too much. There's a lot of people I like down there. Noah's not there anymore. But I'd probably be bugging on you on your door, Dan, quite often, and some other people that I've met on Twitter. Up here in this, I'm in a small village, population 1,300, about 40 minutes outside Vancouver. So there's really no other writers for me to hang out with over here. So I get a ton of writing done. And the reason we were about to move down to LA is because this was before the days of Zoom. The pandemic hit, and unfortunately, there was one positive, which is everyone started Zooming, which allowed me to put the brakes on us moving down to LA and just sort of stay up here. Because of that, I think my productivity is way up there. I'm able to write. I don't have kids. I only have three dogs. They don't have anything to say to me. So I have a lot of energy. All the energy I would spend managing other people that I'm trying to raise through argumentation, or, you know, I was a high school teacher. I know how much energy goes into bargaining with people for behavior. I don't have any of that energy expended, so it just goes into my writing.
And so if you lived in a less beautiful place, the sort of, shall I move down to Hollywood, it might help me thing might be easier, but you'd be giving up a lot more than most people to come down here. So does that mean, I mean, what's your sort of, should I move or should I not move? Or do you think actually now, if some of these shows that you're trying to work, they all work, you can still keep your idyllic Vancouver lifestyle?
If everything works out the way I'm hoping to, after talking to some showrunners who've all told me, the ones that I've grown friends with, they've all said, don't ever sell your place. Just stay up there. And if you get a green light on a show and it happens to be not produced in Vancouver, but in LA or somewhere else, I'll just live in those places for a few months and then come back here with my wife and dogs and just continue doing what I'm doing that's led to those moments.
Yeah.
I want to probe a little bit into the productivity, which you talked about productivity. I have a glimpse into your world through social media, and obviously you and I are friends. I've never been to your house, and I've never spent, you know, any, I've actually never met you face to face. We're exclusively friends over social media and occasionally on Zoom. But, you know, I watch your life from afar, the life that you present to us. I see the amazing food you cook. I see the walks you go on with your dogs. I see your pithy comments on Twitter. I particularly enjoy the comments you direct at Dan at his expense. And then you have a lot of energy, I can tell. And I know from the DMs we exchange that you're pitching a lot, you're producing a lot. But what is your, you know, the how often are you writing a spec? How often are you pitching? What's your balance? Do you like to put words on the page every day? Are you more of an idea guy, generating pitch ideas and not writing specs? What are you doing right now?
Well, right now, I think I told you, Noah, I want to keep this as vague as possible, but I do a lot of general meetings. I do a lot of writing of pitches and a lot of one-pagers. One-pagers that I just give to my reps. And if they get excited about it, they send it out, which leads to generals. Sometimes even I've had four occasions where I would tweet a joke idea that goes viral, and I'll have one of my reps contact me because their assistant saw it and said, can you take that down? We're going to set up a meeting about that very idea. So those things happen, which is weird. 3 weeks ago, I walked into a general with a studio, and I told you this, Noah, And I have three ideas in my pocket. I soft pitch three ideas. And I have one pages for those three ideas. And a week later, I found out they're going ahead with all of them. So now I'm furiously writing full pitches for those three ideas for which I only had one pagers. For one of them, I have a showrunner attached now. For another one, we're trying to attach a showrunner. Another one, I'm trying to attach a lead actor. So I'm constantly writing these pitches right now. What I'm missing is the actual writing of the script. I would love to get past the pilot stage, get a green light so I could write something. My dream is now to write an episode 102 of anything, instead of the pilot, 102 being the second episode of a show just greenlit.
You just brought up something fascinating, and that we haven't actually talked about on this podcast. And I think it's really important to kind of dig into it just for a second longer. Is that you said you bring three ideas to every general meeting. And I think, you know, there's no rule book in Hollywood. There's no, like, a lot of people take a general and they're like, well, that's, I just want to make a friend, or they don't quite know what to do. I see people get asked a lot, like, what are your favorite TV shows? And that feels like a question to me where they're not really guiding the meeting. They're just running out of things to talk about. So somebody will say, what are you watching, to kind of create the new, you know, direction for the conversation. You are bringing in ideas in your back pocket to hopefully get to the point where you are mini pitching people. Now, I think people get confused on what a general is and what a pitch meeting is, but I think you're doing it just right, where it's like, I want to turn this general into money. I want to turn this general into work. And if I just talk about myself for an hour, that's all I'm going to get out of it. So can you talk a little bit more about how you came up with this process and how it works for you? Because I'm guessing it's a very successful strategy that others who follow us might want to start emulating.
I think it comes from both teaching and stand-up comedy, which I used to do, which is, you know, be prepared for different scenarios. Like before a comedy, if you're going up for example, if you go up on a comedy stage on a Friday night and you see a bunch of people walk in with, you know, a phallus, inflatable phalluses on their heads, you know, well, that's a stag at party and they're going to be very rowdy and they're not going to want to pay attention to my slower jokes or more long drawn out stories. They're going to want joke. And they're going to want a little bit of attention to them to quiet them down. Because after they get the attention, they tend to pay attention to the show. So, you know, just being prepared. So before a general, I'll do a little bit of research. I ask my reps, what do they make? What are they known for? I'll try, if possible, look up the executives to see where they come from, what they've made. And then from what they've made usually, or what they've been attached to, not that executives always have the choice in these matters, but, you know, I take a guess as to, like, what excites them. Then I'll have the three ideas that I think I'll be able to soft pitch during the course of the meeting. And sometimes I can't do that. There's no space for it. But if they say something like the question you brought up, Noah, if they say something, what have you been watching? And I know I have in my back pocket, because I watch a lot of stuff, but if I know I've had in my back pocket, for example, Korean gangster series, I'll say I've been watching a lot of Netflix, a lot of Korean gangster stuff, which is why I wrote this. You know, and when I say I write this, they know I mean a one pager. And then I'll say, oh, I'm hoping to do this. And if I see their eyes go wide, then I know I can go a little further and push a little farther. But quite often I'll pitch an idea or throw out an idea, and I'll see nothing, just a polite smile. Oh, that's interesting. That's cool. And I won't go any further. I'm like, that's bad. It's just knowing when to stop selling something that someone doesn't want.
So we're about halfway through the podcast, and most of our polite guests have said, good question, before giving their answers. But obviously that hasn't happened yet. So I feel like we should up our game a little bit. So you mentioned the K word. You mentioned sort of Korean gangster show. I want to talk about sort of diversity as a positive. I know that, see, from, again, following you on social media, when you've talked about some of your things that you're working on, other Koreans in the industry have mentioned as part of that. In today's world, because obviously it's very different from probably where we were maybe 10 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, do you lean into the diversity to both obviously to mine the stories, but also actually how you find ways through the maze of Hollywood?
One of the greatest things for me personally, career-wise, since Parasite won an Oscar, is that it's allowed people like me to lean into who we are, who we authentically are. When I was younger, in my early 20s, when I started writing stage plays, one act plays for myself, I'd always center a white character, a white character that I grew up with, or a white character that I saw myself through. You know, I grew up around white media. I used to wish Mike Brady was my father. I used to wish I were these, you know, I used to wish I was McClane on Die Hard. You know, it's I identified with white characters, and now I'm able to identify not just with those characters, but with characters that actually look like me. That's been the big shift. So I've been able to write stories coming out of my experience. And the great thing about that is the people I'm talking to in generals or in pitch meetings, they know it's coming from a very deep, authentic place. And I think, I feel like this newfound or renewed energy comes out of me telling these stories because I've told watered down versions of them, tell people what I think they want to hear for most of my life. And only in the last 5 or 6 years have I been able to tell them exactly the story I want to say with the exact same characters I had in mind. And because I'm doing that, I think it's like something's unleashed and I think they feel it. And it's been able to help me connect with people, even through a Zoom. I'm able to push through with that energy. I'm just excited to be able to tell these stories. So I remember after Parasite, when I emailed my reps, jokingly reminding them, hey, just so you know, I'm Korean too. And they wrote back, oh, hell, yeah, we know. And right away, I had all these meetings lined up with people I would not have had the chance to pitch or meet prior to that evening. It might have been like 2 years down the road, but it really sped things up for me.
So that's fascinating. I guess, does that put you, so obviously I fully understand, as you know, I've got my family a mixed race, and when my daughter watches TV shows now, you know, the whole thing everyone's had, I think, with The Little Mermaid, you know, when she can identify, it completely changes your view of the entertainment industry when you feel part of it. I'm not saying it's gone too far, but are you now sort of, do people only want you to pitch Korean themed things? Because now actually, like, we don't need you to do a white person one because there's plenty of those, so we want Korean only. Like, has it gone so far full circle now that you only want to hear your authentic story and not anything else?
No, but I've had these, I can't say the studio obviously, but these dream studios approach me for these things that are not Korean. And during the generals, I always find myself, and my reps have talked to me about this, that I try to turn it Korean. Like, is there any way we could make this more Korean? And they're like, well, the IP is not Korean. And I'm like, but can it be? Can we make it? And so, you know, I think I've burned those opportunities. Although, you know, I still have relationships with them. The meetings are fun. But I think I'm at a point in my career, I kind of want to only tell these stories right now until I can get them out of my system. But you know, I don't write just Korean characters right now. But what I'm saying is that the story is essentially, at its core, Korean first, at least the ones I'm taking out.
I think, you know, to this point, that diversity obviously has become really important. But what has become almost more important, in my view, is authenticity of storytelling. They want someone who can tell the story and who's best suited to tell the story. And that doesn't matter, you know, what color you are, where you come from, but they want to know that you can, that you are the person to tell that story, hence the more and more importance on the why me section of any of these pitches. But you know, I want to like talk a little bit more about kind of what's going on in today's TV landscape, because I feel like, you know, being on social media, at least we get this perspective from those on social media, and obviously from the people that Dan and I've interviewed on this podcast, that things are really hard. And every time I think they're getting better, I hear that maybe they're even getting harder. And obviously, in many ways, you're fairly new, and in many ways, you've been around for many, many, many years. So what scares you about the industry right now, and do you see a way through it?
You know, I felt so underprepared being invited onto this podcast where I listen. I'm not just friends with you guys. I'm a fan of your podcast because you have heavily experienced showrunners and writers, actors and directors sharing their experiences that span decades, which is why I didn't want to be on the show as a guest, as a guy who's only been this 5-6 years. So I have very little insight into that thing, except for the little bit I've seen from 2018 to even now. 2018, I was able to pitch straight to the buyers. And then 2 years later, I had to get involved with studios. And then I learned at that point, oh, that's actually the norm. I was just, you know, sometimes you have beginner's luck. I remember the first time I swung a golf club and I did really well. And I thought, well, I'm going to be this is how I'm going to make my living at golf. And I sucked right afterwards. Right? Just beginner's luck. It's like that. Then I found out this is the way you're supposed to do it, through a studio. And now I'm like, I just signed an if-come deal this week. Nothing wrong with an if-come deal, but that's, for those of you who don't know, it means no money right now. It means money when you eventually pitch. And it's a lot of work to do between now, the signing of that deal, getting the pitch, getting the attachments, and then taking it out to town probably in the new year, in January, February. And then if they say yes, goes through business affairs, maybe for like 4 to 6 months, and that's when I'll get paid if I'm able to sell it. So that's what scares me, the long road to payment in this kind of thing. In the real world, if anything takes that long for you to get paid for work, someone's knocking at your door with wearing brass knuckles. But in this industry, this is the norm, and it does frighten me. Luckily, I have other things I can sell, which I've done this year. Like I've sold podcasts that I'm developing as well, and other media. But I fear for people who are in my position, or just below, or coming in newer, just able to just doing TV, because I don't know how you're supposed to pay the bills doing that.
This model is unsustainable and needs to change. And I hope they take it on our newest guild negotiations, because it's 8 to 10 months to get paid. It's, you know, you have a job, you got your first TV job, you quit your other job because you have to. And then you're going for your second job and you get it right away. And it's still 10 months before you get your next paycheck. People can't sustain on that, can't survive.
Yeah. And the one thing I wish someone had told me is that to work in Hollywood, you need money. You need, like, I thought, you know, the idea is to get there, sell the thing, become rich. But luckily my wife is successful, and she's at one point after her business started taking off, and I was substitute teaching again, and she said, you know, the Black Tape is doing well enough and our business is doing well enough, you don't have to teach anymore. Like, financially, you know, we're good now. You could devote it fully to writing because you got a manager now. Let's see what happens there. And that's what allowed me to have this career, like my wife having the money already, and my money came afterwards. But, you know, it's without that, I don't know how in the world I'm supposed to be this productive. That's the only thing that allows me to write all this stuff and have these pitches ready, having a smart, rich wife.
So if you had a choice to make, obviously, as a regular listener, you know, I sometimes give people choices of which type of success they would like. If you had a choice between somebody calling you up and offering you a very, very serious amount of money to do another podcast because they know you're very good at it and there's money to be made in podcasts, so real money for a real length of time, takes all the risk out of what comes next for you, or you get a chance to make a, probably, maybe it is the Korean gangster TV series, but a real authentic story from the heart with people you want to work with, but it's commercially doesn't necessarily have a lot of legs, but you get to make that one thing you really want. And then the third thing is you get the chance to make something which is not a Korean story, but is successful and goes for multiple seasons and there's plenty of money in it, but you have to move to LA. Which of those three successes would you choose to take?
Oh, that's a good question. I would probably go with three. Is this third one the third one a commercially viable product that it moved to LA? Just enough, yeah. But good money? Probably that one, because my goal right now is to help my wife retire. She's worked her ass off to help me get the career where I needed to be, where I can now sort of provide, but it's still too risky right now. I'm not guaranteed to sell something every year. So my goal is to get her to be able to happily retire, to pursue the thing that she loves. And I know she loves LA. If we can go to LA and I can provide for us and she doesn't have to work her job anymore, I would pick that.
Interesting. And then once you're there, would you then try and do number two?
Yes. Okay. I would switch over. And once I have the money, it's in the bag, everything's paid for, tell the stories that are really important to me.
So it's not quite the same question again, but it's just, obviously, when you podcasted, which, you know, we talked about at the beginning, came out of not being able to get where you wanted to with traditional screenwriting, you got very good at it. And there's, particularly nowadays, there's very serious money in podcasting. And, you know, you're, both of your shows have got commercials running in them and people are paying lots of money for that. Is there a part of you with maybe one eye on making your life, your wife happy and your life easier, knowing you know how to crack that world, which a lot of, like, I know obviously this podcast Noah's doing is successful, but a lot of screenwriters won't be thinking, I'm going to go off and do a scripted podcast to make lots of money. But you know how to do that. Is there a part of you that thinks maybe I should just do that because I maybe can get to number one this time with a scripted podcast and leave some of the ridiculousness of trying to do the non-past version, non-podcast version of Hollywood alone?
I am doing that. I haven't stopped trying to do that. The problem is in terms of like a scale of payment. Whenever I start doing that with an audio drama, I'll sell something in TV, and because the payment for that pilot is you know, that's what I live on for the year. All my energy now goes to that, and I have to put the podcast away for a second. This year's one, I have a development deal with a podcast company. So it's much like a TV commitment. Like we signed the contract, it went through business affairs. So that one I can't put away. I'm working on that one at the same time. But when it's my own project that I think I can get to, you know, in the top 10, every time I get close, I have to shelve it because of something that moves forward in the TV side.
Oh, unfortunately, this brings us, I would obviously, Paul, I love you, and I would talk to you for hours and hours. And one day you and I will do a 22-hour long podcast, I'm sure to the enjoyment of a single person. But I'll keep you on here all day, but we've come, you know, full circle, and I need to ask you the last question, which at this point, you could probably tell us what that last question is, because you've listened to, you know, to a lot of our episodes, but I will say it anyways. If you had to give one piece of advice to somebody joining this business as either a TV writer, feature writer, or audio podcaster, what would it be?
This is advice I've given quite often, and I sort of hinted at it in this episode, but even more so in the new economy of this industry, I'm going to double down on this advice. If you don't live in LA, but you want to work in TV, try not to move to LA until someone pays you to move. There's different ways to sort of make your mark and attract attention to yourself. I've always used in my career what I call a peacock model, like stand on the ground that you're in, that field, with a bit more room, unfurl your feathers, and draw people toward you. The person who likes your feathers will eventually turn their head and see you, because it's not that crowded where you are, right? You just have to keep standing there, though. It might take a while, but you have to keep unfurling it and standing there. And someone will find you and they will come to you. You won't have to go to them. That happened with me. It took a long time. It took a few decades. But every time I went to LA, there would be some kind of failure before that, which I learned from. But when I made my mark in Vancouver and was able to, you know, have people from LA and different parts of the world contact me while I was in Vancouver, that's what made the difference.
Fantastic. Excellent answer. As they all have been, we've been wanting to have you on for a while and we have not been disappointed. I know you reached out to me earlier today to ask if you could give like a sort of 10-minute segment on how Noah could improve his questions, but I just don't think we're going to have time for that today. So we're going to have to end it. But I just want to say, Paul Bay, friend of the podcast, actor whose Korean consists of menu items and having his head blown off, but excellent writer, excellent podcaster, excellent screenwriter who no doubt has got increasing amounts of success around the corner. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And I can't wait for the day you actually move to Los Angeles and we can go out and have a drink together.
Yeah. Have me back on after I get a green light. Then I can actually talk about the success part of this equation. But thank you, gentlemen. And thank you, Dan.
Well, that's a wrap on this episode of Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss. As always, this episode was brought to you by Scriptation, the screenwriting and annotation software that at the very least has made my life easier and will make your life easier as well. We'd like to thank our wives who put up with us recording these episodes in our offices and basements and closets and bathrooms and anywhere we can get a little space to record an interview. And of course, we want to thank James Launch, who provided us with the great intro and outro music.
If you want to find us on social media, you can find Noah at N Evslin on Twitter, tweeting a variety of writer-based nonsense and some terrible puns and occasionally begging for sponsorship. If you want more refined tweets, mostly about football and whiskey, you can find me at Dan Rutstein. If you're interested in buying a copy of Scriptation, if you go to www.scriptation.com/Sitha, S-I-T-H-A, you will receive a special discount. Thank you very much for listening. As always, we appreciate you. Please give us any feedback, mostly positive stuff about me, and we will see you next week.
And if you do say a negative thing about Dan, there is a chance I might buy you a free copy of Scriptation.